I'm going to tell you a story today. And it starts with the Buddha. As I imagine you know, he was born maybe in northern India or southern Nepal, maybe closer to Afghanistan, maybe about 2,500 years ago. Let's assume that he was born in southern Nepal in the foothills of the Himalayas. A little over 2,500 years ago. And he was born into a noble family, and it was foretold that he would either become a great wheel rolling, Dharma rolling king and succeed his father, or he would become a great teacher. So his father tried to protect him from any horrible things so that he would become the king and not go off and teach people. But of course, eventually he saw sickness, old age, and death, and learned that these things come to all of us, and he was very concerned about this, and eventually he did go off and became a wandering seeker and studied with various teachers and surpassed each of them, but didn't want to stay and teach because nothing seemed to answer his question. What was this about, this suffering? And then he decided to become an ascetic, and he lived a life of great austerity. And that's where you see those statues of Buddha with his ribs showing, like you could see his backbone from the front. And at some point he decided that this wasn't really making sense. It wasn't really getting it. And he remembered a time in his youth when he had sat under a rose apple tree, and it had been very sweet and a really lovely spring day, a soft breeze, and he had just sat quietly. And he thought, what if I tried that, something like that, just sitting quietly? That kind of contentment is not selfish or harmful. And so he washed himself, and he washed his clothes or his robe or whatever he had, and dressed in clean clothes, washed his hair. I mean, he had been living, letting the horses pee on him and stuff. Seriously ascetic. And then somebody, a woman, Sujata, mistaking him for the river god, brought him some food, a bowl of yogurt, and he ate. And then he sat down, and he just sat zazen for quite a while. And then one day he decided, I'm going to sit here until I figure it out. And he sat for 7 days. And on the night of the seventh day, he struggled. Mara, the evil one, came and tried to tempt him, sending first armies to attack him, but didn't work. And he sent beautiful women to tempt him and enticing food that didn't work. Nothing worked. And so finally Mara came to him and said, who do you think you are? Your father needs you. Your people need you. And you're sitting around contemplating your navel. What use is that? Who do you think you are? And Buddha just took his hand. He had been sitting like this, right? He took his hand, and he was sitting full lotus, I'm sure. He took his hand and he reached forward and he touched the earth. calling on the earth for support and for validation. And the earth shook. And then he felt validated, supported, that he was not doing something out of selfishness. And through that night, he contemplated the Dharma, and he came to understand the Four Noble Truths. Life is dis-ease, that there's a reason for it, then there is a way out of it, and that way is the Eightfold Path. And he came to understand what we call now dependent co-arising. That this is this way because that is that way. That our ignorant belief in a self propels this chain forward. And then he saw the morning star and he thought that I, together with all beings, am now enlightened. And he simply enjoyed the quiet. And then Indra, Empress of the gods, came to him and said, please, please teach. And he was hesitant because he thought nobody would understand. And it would just be vexing to him and to everybody. And Indra said, no, no, there are those who understand. So Buddha decided, okay, I'll try. And so he went forth, and lo and behold, the first people he met were the five other mendicants who had been practicing ascetic way with him. And they saw him coming in the distance, and they said, we have to shun him. He, look at him. He's been eating, and he's clean. No, that's not the way. We have to shun him. He's failed. But they couldn't move away. And as he came closer, they felt that they could. I certainly they could not get away, but also I think they felt drawn to him. And then he talked to them, and he I guess you'd say preached his first, he gave his first Dharma talk, first wheel rolling Dharma talk about these principles that he had learned. And then he began to teach. And he attracted a great deal, a great many followers. And what they used to do was they would during the dry season, they would wander about begging in towns and villages and sleeping where they could find refuge. And they would go in smaller groups because it might be really hard for a small village to support them. You know, and then they'd stay for a while and they would teach from their understanding. And then during the monsoon season, they would all gather together with the Buddha, and then he would teach. And eventually they broke up into smaller groups, even for that, because there were just too many of them. And there were certain lead disciples that we hear about every so often. There was Shariputra, who was first in wisdom, really good at figuring things out. I'd say he probably lived in his head a lot. And the Heart Sutra is directed at him. Avalokiteshvara is talking to Shariputra and saying, no, 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 no. Because Shariputra was attached to his lists. And then there's Shibuti, who was first in kindness, whose practice was kindness. And he was considered, I don't know, a little slow and maybe not particularly admirable. And yet, later on in the Mahayana Sutras, it's Shambhuti who is speaking for the Buddha. And it's Shambhuti who is the kind of teaching interlocutor with the Buddha. So they go along. There was also, just in case, there's Mahakashyapa, who was the one when Buddha ascended the seat to teach, and he held up a flower, and Mahakashyapa smiled. And Buddha said, "He has my true Dharma eye." In our lineage, he is the first ancestor after Buddha. And the Japanese pronounce his name, what is it? Shakyamuni Buddha Siddhayosho Makakasho. I can only do it when I chant the ancestors. Mahakashyapa was the first to just get it. And I think that's why he's the first Zen ancestor. Because it was a direct knowing. So they go along, and when he was 80 years old, the Buddha died. And they tried to continue to follow his teaching, but there were two, probably a lot. I mean, they continued their way of practice, right? And they didn't split up like, oh, we're the Nikaya Buddhists, Theravada elders, and we follow the way of Buddha, and we're making lists of all the dharmas, and we're just following this formula. And there's these others that said, you're too monastic, and you're not paying attention to life as it is, and you're not paying attention to being useful to people. You're much too bound up with your own studies. They weren't in separate groups. The ones who are making the lists and so on, we sometimes call, nowadays called Nikaya Buddhists, the early Mahayanists, and actually Suzuki Roshi and lots of people call them Hinayana, which is a lesser vehicle. It's not very nice. At any rate, the ones who said, felt that it, more drawn to being useful and entering into, I don't know, the life of the people, so became known as Mahayana, but they weren't so separate. And you could say, I mean, some of it's just personality, right? But it was also views. It was a approach to teaching the Dharma. After 100 years, they convened a big assembly, and Buddha's attendant Ananda recited all the sutras. And I don't know if they wrote them down yet, but at any rate, he recited them all because he could remember. That's why sutras often start, "Thus have I heard." That's Ananda speaking. "Thus have I heard." And the Mahayana Sutras probably came later. Sometimes they start, "Thus have I heard," anyway, but he didn't hear that. However, even in the earlier sutras, you can see references that sound familiar, that are references to emptiness and being useful and paying attention to what's right in front of you and so on. It's not like there was some definite line or split. It was more, they're like this, and then they started, I think, separating more. And the Nikaya Buddhists became more intrigued with what we call the Abhidharma. And the Abhidharma is, I guess you could say, the study of the mind. But they made lists. There were lists of mental formations, and there were lists of hindrances and lists of kinds of consciousness, and on and on. And then there were those like Vasubandhu and Nagarjuna. Actually, it was Nagarjuna first and then Vasubandhu, but who said, who felt that this was getting much too scholastic, and that and was kind of going off wrong. It was like the people that made the lists got so attached to their lists, they decided that there were some dharmas that were permanent and not empty. And so then there was a reaction or a response to that from Nagarjuna, saying it's all empty, even Buddha is empty, and nothing arises except from causes and conditions. And no thing arises at all. It's just, you think the Heart Sutra has a lot of no's. Well, Nagarjuna is nothing else. Wonderful. Study Nagarjuna, you get really queasy. And then Vasubandhu came along, and I would say it kind of explained how it works. And he does have some lists. He was an Abhidharma expert who changed his views, essentially. And so he talks about how we create this sense of self, and how to practice letting go of it, how to see that it's a construct. Everything we see is a construct. And a little before Nagarjuna, we're talking about the early CE. There were these Prajnaparamita, this wisdom literature started appearing. And there are a bunch of sutras. The Heart Sutra is one. There's the thing that the study group is on, the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. And there are longer ones. There's the Diamond Sutra. There's the Lotus Sutra. And they all emphasize the notion of a bodhisattva. And they all emphasize emptiness. They all emphasize the sense of no self, no thing. No, 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 no. And that's a very Mahayana approach. Non-attachment. Non-production. Non-production means not striving after, not making something solid of what is in fact fluid. Just over and over in various ways saying, don't do it. Or look how you do it. You know, of course you have to see the table is solid, right? Put your plate down on it. You sit on the chair. You don't want to stub your toe. But you don't have to take it so seriously. And in a sense, you could say that they were know, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, criticizing those who were making a thing of the Dharma, solidifying the Dharma. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha is preaching to the assembly, and he introduces this notion of no self, of emptiness, of nothing solid. And a bunch of people can't stand it, and they get up and leave. And in the sutra, he says, "That's okay, let them go. They're just a bunch of twigs and leaves or something. I don't, not quite trash, but close enough. It's only, I mean, who knows? You know, somebody's writing this, so." But that's the only time I ever saw the Buddha be snarky or snide or whatever, dismissive. This is the Mahayana literature. The Mahayana is what's called the great vehicle. And in the Lotus Sutra, it's introduced as an actual vehicle. It's called the great vehicle. Maha is great. It's called the great vehicle because it is inclusive. It doesn't try to pick nits. It doesn't make a lot of lists. Some because they were Indian people. In the olden days, I don't know about now, but they like their lists. They're very analytical. Mahayana holds up the image of a bodhisattva, a wisdom-seeking being. Bodhi is wisdom. It's the perfection of wisdom. It's the wisdom that's gone beyond. It's not book learning. It's the deep wisdom that you carry in your bones. Sattva means being. So the bodhisattva is a wisdom being. And they're also called mahasattvas, great beings, because they're engaged in this great work of letting go and being useful. Letting go and responding to the cries of the world. From their place within the world, not holding themselves up here in the monastery and telling people what's going on. No, being with. Compassion, suffering with, feeling with. That's a bodhisattva, and that's the Mahayana ideal. And the sutras are the Mahayana sutras, these great Mahayana sutras are meant to at least encourage us to practice letting go. It's such a shopworn phrase, unfortunately, letting go. It's also extremely useful. That's why, in some sense, the Heart Sutra is nothing but a huge yes. But you get to the yes by saying no. No to all these fetters. No to all these parts of yourself that I'm debating again, confuse you. No, that It says no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. I have eyes. I have a nose. I taste things. So on. I have thoughts. My brain seems to do thinking. So what does it mean? And that's part of what the Heart Sutra is about. You know, it's like it pokes you. Don't make something solid of this. What are your eyes really? What's going on here? Why are you so attached to your bodily functions, to your senses? Why are your senses leading you around? Why is it that your sense of taste leads you to be a glutton? Why do your eyes encourage you to lust after people and things? No, you know, it's almost like it's saying, you know, like you, I might do to a little kid. I don't think, probably not, but at any rate, you know, it's sort of like, no. And a bodhisattva does not pull away. The Manjushri is tough love, maybe. Manjushri is usually pictured with a sword cutting through delusion. And Samantabhadra, usually shown on an elephant. Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of shining practice. Samantabhadra keeps coming back and always pays attention. And Avalokiteshvara, she is the bodhisattva who hears the cries of the world, the bodhisattva of compassion, pictured with number of hands and arms, sometimes 1,000, and sometimes only, oh, I don't know, 8 or 10. And sometimes with useful utensils in all of them. All of them. And it's Avalokiteshvara who teaches the Heart Sutra. Surprising, it's a wisdom sutra, but it's not Manjushri teaching it. With all those no's, it sounds more like Manjushri, like, cut it out, stop it. But it's Avalokiteshvara who knows our suffering. Because all of those no's and the gigantic demonstrate great, great, deep compassion. So this, and the compassion grows out of emptiness when we really let go of our self-concern and self-protectiveness. We are then open and ready and available to respond, not react, respond to the cries of the world. Then we can be truly useful. And these sutras are ways of supporting us to do this work of letting go. And they encourage us There's a lot in the Lotus Sutra that's simply encouraging. And they slap us upside the head. Whatever it takes. I mean, I could imagine somebody writing some of these and saying, whatever it takes. And now in the United States, these things are coming back together somewhat because there are a lot of what are called Vipassana teachers, which is a branch of Nikaya Buddhism here in this country. They at Spirit Rock will talk about bodhisattvas. And I don't know if they talk about emptiness a lot. I'm sure they do some. And they're more eclectic than other branches of Vipassana Buddhism, but at any rate, they certainly talk about bodhisattvas. However, there's not the emphasis, and I don't know that there's the emphasis that there is in these wisdom sutras about letting go of all of your ideas about yourself. Is it, don't believe everything you think? At any rate, Zen is a Mahayana school, as are Tibetan and Korean Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism mostly, and Vietnamese, and most of the rest of Southeast Asia is more Nikaya Buddhist. And what has spread to the West is, they both spread to the West, but here Tibetan and Zen, both Rinzai and Soto, are they're all, and there's a big Korean contingent, Korean Zen contingent here in the United States. They're all Mahayana schools. So I hope that's useful. You have to explore it and let it permeate you. They use the term in the olden days, it perfumes your life. It perfumes your life. And Suzuki Roshi used to say, it's like going out for a walk in the fog, and after a while you notice that your clothes are wet. Just do it and don't worry about where you're going or what you're going to get. Just do it. See what happens. Easy to say. So, you have any comments or questions? Steve? And then Elena?
I wonder if you see a movement or any usefulness in Mahayana Buddhism in the West, sort of incorporating more, coming together with Nikaya at all.
I think it's useful that we've...
I'm not quite picturing what that would look like, but your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's good that we're not using the word Hinayana anymore. And... it feels to me more like the Nikaya, I mean, the Vipassana people are incorporating some notions that are Mahayana notions, say. I don't know how they would say it. No, because it used to be that we'd say, well, Hinayana people are concerned with their own enlightenment. and cutting off all feelings and thoughts, and reaching final nirvana, extinction. And we, Mahayana, we're concerned about remaining in the world and being useful to people. And we think we don't want to cut off samsara. Samsara is like the daily world of suffering and confusion. We don't want to cut it off. We understand that nirvana and samsara are the same thing. The difference is just is simply in how you approach your samsaric life. So people don't like that way of, they don't think of it that way, I guess, or they feel like that's pejorative. Which it is. I mean, it sounds that way, you know, oh, well, you just care about your own liberation, you know, and what about the rest of us? So I think probably, well, I don't know about Nikaya Buddhism affecting Mahayana so much. Maybe. I think the more I think of, I have some idea of modern scholarship, but you know, I don't quote me. No, but that they really started out, you know, they started out to be, oh, we used to also say that Hinayana started and then Mahayana was grew out of criticism of the Hinayana being too monastic and rigid, and that it needed to go out to the people. But it wasn't so much, they were both there at the same time. It wasn't that there was this and then this grew out of it so much. I think they both grew out of the same root, and then there was a different emphasis. So the thing is that I don't think that the early teachings of Buddha belong to either school. I think it's useful. You should reach the or foundations of mindfulness. You should be familiar with that Dharma talk, the really early one, the early teachings of the Buddha. And I mean, some of the Abhidharma we do pay attention to, but just not so much into it. So that's, I mean, I don't have any particular opinion about it. I mean, I think that's, they people in Nikaya Buddhism should understand the notion of bodhisattva. I think it's really useful. A way-seeking being. Elena?
I just wanted to comment how I really appreciated the very last parts you were saying about, you know, just doing it or the letting it perfume, because I find myself trying not to overthink this practice and that to just sit and to breathe and to do and to try, because I know that I'm going to keep living in the world, the present world. Like, I'm not going to be, the likeliness of me becoming, you know, a nun anytime soon is not very likely. And I don't see myself shutting out from society. It's, and how can I take this practice and just be a better person out there navigating the suffering? And so I appreciate that. I'm also, you know, I'm watching and seeing how my partner is delving very, very deeply and studying all the sutras again. And I admire that. And I know that at some point I need to take time and study more, but I'm comfortable in, like I said, just in the practicing and then just trying to, you know, for no better words, live life on life's terms and not buy into the suffering, but knowing that the suffering's there and not contributing to the suffering. So I just, like I said, this whole idea when you said that the perfuming or the fog and the just doing it, my meditation feels like it has become such more of a center focal point of my day, every day. And I mean, it's been that way for a while, but even it just feels even stronger since joining this group. So I don't know. It was more comment than question. So thank you.
Jody?
I appreciated the talk, and I could relate to what Ellen was talking about. You know, my wife said to me this morning, I was sharing with her the chant about life, protecting life, and was telling her I had looked up the translation of that, and she says, well, why don't you just chant the translation? Why chant the Japanese? You know, wouldn't it be more meaningful? And I think it goes to that idea for me of having some balance between, you know, understanding what I'm doing, but not so much that it pulls me away from really just letting it kind of fill me up and sort of stay in me. I don't know how else to say that. Like, not just having it up here, but really allowing it to penetrate within. And I know mind and body are the same thing, but for the sake of what I'm trying to explain, like having some idea in my head, but also letting it penetrate into my being and kind of living from like this integrated place. And so I shared with her, yeah, I looked it up because I do want to understand what I'm chanting. I want to know what that means, you know? And at the same time, I can appreciate chanting in the Japanese in Japanese, and also not maybe not understanding every single word within the chant, because I can feel that in my body and I can sort of let sort of the emotion come up from that. And I find both to be equally powerful. So for me, I think my practice is trying to have a nice balance of the two and not going so far over one side or the other, but sort of the middle, trying to have sort of the middle way, so to speak, what I would say is my middle way of kind of heart mind sort of integration. I know the practice would say that mind and body are not separate, but in this world that I live in, it does at times feel very separate, and I compartmentalize very well. So in the practice, trying to bring those, knowingly bring those together as one thing.
Beings are numberless.